The Hollingsworth argument began with Charles Cooper arguing on behalf of the petitioners. In this exchange, Justice Ginsburg questions Cooper on whether the proponents of Proposition 8 have standing to defend it in court.
Have we ever granted standing to proponents of ballot initiatives?
No, Your Honor. The court has not done that, but the court has never had before it a clear expression from a unanimous state's high court.
Well, this is the concern is certainly the proponents are interested in getting it on the ballot and seeing that all the proper procedures are followed. But once it's passed, they have no proprietary interest in it. It's law for them, just as it is for everyone else. So how are they distinguishable from the California citizenry in general?
Picking up on the same theme, Justice Kagan and Chief Justice Roberts inquired into whether a state could assign the responsibility of defending a statute.
Could the state assign to any citizen the right to defend a judgment of this kind?
Justice Kagan, that would be a very tough question. It's by no means the question before the court, because it isn't any citizen. It is the official proponents that have a specific and carefully detailed.
Well, if you would, on the hypothetical, could a state just assign to anybody the ability to do this?
Your Honor, I think it very well might. It very well might be able to decide that any citizen could step forward and represent the interests of the state and the people in defending.
I'm sorry, you finished?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That may be true in terms of who they want to represent, but a state can't authorize anyone to proceed in federal court because that would leave the definition under Article 3 of the federal Constitution as to who has standing to bring claims up to each state. And I don't think we've ever allowed anything like that.
In this next exchange, Justice Sotomayor asks Cooper whether the proponents have suffered an injury that would be sufficient to give them standing in this case.
How does it create an injury to them separate from that of every other taxpayer to have laws enforced?
Your Honor, the question before the court I would submit is not the injury to the individual proponents. It's the injury to the state. The legislators in the Karcher case had no individual particularized injury, and yet this court recognized they were proper representatives of the state's interests, the state's injury.
At least one of the amici has suggested that it seems counterintuitive to think that the state is going to delegate to people who don't have a fiduciary duty to them, that it's going to delegate the responsibility of representing the state to individuals who have their own views. They proposed the ballot initiative because it was their individual views, not necessarily that of the state. So Justice Scalia proffered the question of the Attorney General. The Attorney General has no personal interest.
True. No.
He has a fiduciary obligation.
The Attorney General, whether it's a fiduciary obligation or not, is in normal circumstances the representative of the state to defend the validity of the state's enactments when they are challenged in federal court. But when that officer doesn't do so, the state surely has every authority and, I would submit, the responsibility to identify particularly an initiative.
From here, the court turned to the merits of the case. In this exchange, Justice Ginsburg asks about the relevance of a prior Supreme Court case from 1971.
The issues, the constitutional issues that have been presented to the court are not of first impression here. In Baker against Nelson, this court unanimously dismissed for want of a substantial federal question.
Mr. Cooper, Baker and Nelson was 1971. The Supreme Court hadn't even decided that gender-based classifications get any kind of heightened scrutiny.
Then that's true.
The same-sex intimate conduct was considered criminal in many states in 1971. So I don't think we can extract much from Baker against Nelson.
Well, Your Honor, certainly I acknowledge the precedential limitations of a summary dismissal. But Baker against Nelson also came fairly fast on the heels of the Loving decision. And Your Honor, I simply make the observation that it seems implausible in the extreme, frankly, for nine justices to have seen no substantial federal question if it is true, as the respondents maintain, that the traditional definition of marriage, insofar as it does not include same-sex couples, insofar as it is a gendered definition, is irrational and can only be explained as a result of anti-gay malice and a bare desire to harm.
Justice Sotomayor then asked whether differential treatment on the basis of sexual orientation could be justified in any context other than marriage.
Outside of the marriage context, can you think of any other rational basis, reason, for a state using sexual orientation as a factor in denying homosexuals benefits or imposing burdens on them? Is there any other rational decision-making that the government could make? Denying them a job, not granting them benefits of some sort, any other decision?
Your Honor, I cannot. I do not have anything to offer you in that regard.
If that is true, then why aren't they a class? If they're a class that makes any other discrimination improper, irrational, then why aren't we treating them as a class for this one benefit? Are you saying that the interest of marriage is so much more compelling than any other interest the state could have?
No, Your Honor, we're certainly not. We are saying the interest in marriage and the state's interest, society's interest in what we have framed as responsible procreation is vital. But at bottom, with respect to those interests, our submission is that same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples are simply not similarly situated.
This next excerpt is a dialogue among Cooper, Justice Scalia, and Justice Ginsburg about some of the possible justifications for Proposition 8.
I believe that this experiment, which is now only fairly 4 years old, even in Massachusetts, the oldest state that is conducting it, to say, I think it better for California to hit the pause button and await additional information from the jurisdictions where this experiment is still maturing.
Mr. Cooper, let me give you one concrete thing. I don't know why you don't mention some concrete things. If you redefine marriage to include same-sex couples, you must permit adoption by same-sex couples. And there's considerable disagreement among sociologists as to what the consequences of raising a child in a single-sex family, whether that is harmful to the child or not. Some states do not permit adoption by same-sex couples for that reason.
California,
I don't think we know the answer
California
to that.
Do you
know the answer to that, whether it harms or helps the child?
No, Your Honor. And there's
but that's a possible deleterious effect, isn't it?
Your Honor, it is certainly among the...
Wouldn't be in California, Mr. Cooper, because that's not an issue, is it? In California, you can have same-sex couples adopting a child.
That's right, Your Honor. That is true. But Your Honor, here's the point.
It's true, but irrelevant. They're arguing for a nationwide rule which applies to states other than California, that every state must allow marriage by same-sex couples. And so even those states that believe it is harmful, and I take no position on whether it's harmful or not, but it is certainly true that there's no scientific answer to that question at this point in time.
Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan then asked Cooper about the argument that Proposition 8 promotes the government's interest in procreation.
You said that the problem is marriage as an institution that furthers procreation.
Yes, sir.
And the reason there was adoption. But that doesn't apply to California. So imagine I wall off California and I'm looking just there where you say that doesn't apply. Now, what happens to your argument about the institution of marriage as a tool towards procreation, given the fact that in California, too, couples that aren't gay but can't have children get married all the time?
Yes, Your Honor. The concern is that redefining marriage as a genderless institution will sever its abiding connection to its historic, traditional, procreative purposes. And it will refocus the purpose of marriage and the definition of marriage away from the raising of children and to the emotional needs and desires of adults, of adult couples.
Well, suppose
and that
a
in
state
turn,
said, Mr. Cooper, suppose a state said, because we think that the focus of marriage really should be on procreation, we're not going to give marriage licenses anymore to any couple where both people are over the age of 55. Would that be constitutional?
No, Your Honor, it would not be constitutional.
Because that's the same state interest, I would think. You know, if you're over the age of 55, you don't help us serve the government's interest in regulating procreation through marriage. So why is that different?
Your Honor, even with respect to couples over the age of 55, it is very rare that both parties to the couple are infertile. And the traditional
no, really, because if a couple, I can just assure you, if both the woman and the man are over the age of 55, there are not a lot of children coming out of that marriage.
Your Honor, society's interest in responsible procreation isn't just with respect to the procreative capacities of the couple itself. The marital norm, which imposes the obligations of fidelity and monogamy, Your Honor, advances the interest in responsible procreation by making it more likely that neither party, including the fertile party, to that.
Actually,
suppose we could have a questionnaire at the marriage desk when people come in to get their marriage. You know, are you fertile or are you not fertile? I suspect this court would hold that to be an unconstitutional invasion of privacy, don't you think?
Well, I just asked about age. I didn't ask about anything else. That's not we ask about people's age all the time.
The next attorney to argue was Ted Olson on behalf of the challengers to Proposition 8. At the outset of his argument, he also addressed standing. In this excerpt, Justice Kennedy questions whether his position would effectively undermine the initiative process in California.
California cannot create Article 3 standing by designating whoever it wants to defend the state of California in connection
but
with the ballot.
But this is not whoever it wants. These are five proponents of the measure, and if we were to accept your argument, it would give the state a one-way ratchet. The state could go in and make a defense, maybe a half-hearted defense, of the statute, and then when the statute is held invalid, simply leave. On the other hand, if the state loses, the state can appeal. So this is a one-way ratchet that favors the state and allows governors and other constitutional officers in different states to thwart the initiative process.
Continuing the standing discussion, here the Chief Justice expresses the view that there may be parties other than the proponents of Prop 8 who might have standing to defend it in court.
I suppose there might be people out there with their own personal standing, someone who performs marriages and would like that to remain open to everyone, but would prefer not to perform same-sex marriages. Or other people, we seem to be addressing the case as if the only options are the proponents here or the state. I'm not sure there aren't other people out there with individual personalized injury that would satisfy Article 3.
The court then turned to the merits of the respondent's argument. Here, Justice Scalia presses Olson on his constitutional position.
The California Supreme Court, like this Supreme Court, decides what the law is. The California Supreme Court decided that the equal protection and due process clauses of that California Constitution did not permit excluding gays and lesbians from the right to get married.
You've led me right into a question I was going to ask. The California Supreme Court decides what the law is. That's what we decide, right? We don't prescribe law for the future. We decide what the law is. I'm curious, when did it become unconstitutional to exclude homosexual couples from marriage? 1791, 1868, when the 14th Amendment was adopted? Sometime after Baker, where we said it didn't even raise a substantial federal question? When did the law become this?
I may answer this in the form of a rhetorical question. When did it become unconstitutional to prohibit interracial marriages? When did it become unconstitutional to assign children to
separate
schools?
Easy question, I think, for that one. At the time that the Equal Protection Clause was adopted. That's absolutely true. But don't give me a question to my question. When do you think it became unconstitutional? Has it always been unconstitutional?
When the California Supreme Court faced the decision, which it had never faced before, is does excluding gay and lesbian citizens who are a class based upon their status as homosexuals, is it constitutional?
That's not when it became unconstitutional. That's when they acted in an unconstitutional matter. In an unconstitutional manner. When did it become unconstitutional to prohibit gays from marrying?
Then they did not assign a date to a Justice Scalia, as you know. What the court decided was a case that came before.
I'm not talking about the California Supreme Court. I'm talking about your argument. You say it is now unconstitutional.
Yes.
Was it always unconstitutional?
It was constitutional when we, as a culture, determined that sexual orientation is a characteristic of individuals that they cannot control.
I see. When did that happen?
There's no specific date in time. This is an evolution.
Well, how am I supposed to know how to decide a case?
Because
then,
the case
you
that's
can't
before
give me
you,
a date when the Constitution
case that's
changes.
Before you today, California decided. The citizens of California decided, after the California Supreme Court decided that individuals had a right to get married irrespective of their sexual orientation in California, and then the Californians decided in Proposition 8, wait a minute, we don't want those people to be able to get married.
Here, Justice Kennedy suggests that perhaps the court shouldn't decide these issues in this case. Which suggests the possibility that the court could dismiss the petition as improvidently granted.
The problem with the case is that you're really asking, particularly because of the sociological evidence you cite, for us to go into uncharted waters. And you can play with that metaphor. There's a wonderful destination or there's a cliff, whatever the metaphor is. But you're doing so in a case where the opinion is very narrow. Basically, that once the state goes halfway, it has to go all the way or 70% of the way. And you're doing so in a case where there's a substantial question on standing. I just wonder if the case was properly granted.
Oh, the case was certainly properly granted, Your Honor. I mean, there was a full trial of all of these issues. There was a 12-day trial. The judge insisted on evidence on all of these questions. This is a...
But that's not the issue the Ninth Circuit decided.
The issue, yes, the Ninth Circuit looked at it and decided because of your decision in the Romer case, of this court's decision in the Romer case, that it could be decided on the narrower issue, but it certainly was an appropriate case to grant. And those issues that I've been describing are certainly fundamental to the case.
Arguing for the government was Solicitor General Donald Verrilli in support of the challengers to Prop 8. In this exchange with Justice Breyer, Verrilli argues that the court does not need to decide the broader constitutional issues surrounding same-sex marriage, but can leave those issues for future cases.
A state that does nothing for gay couples hurts them much more than a state that does something. And, of course, it's true that it does hurt their argument that they do quite a lot. But which are their good arguments, in your opinion? I mean, take a state that really does nothing whatsoever. They have no benefits, no nothing, no nothing, okay? And moreover, if you're right, even in California, if they're right, or, you know, if a PAC is enough, they won't get federal benefits, those that are tied to marriage, because they're not married. So a state that does nothing hurts them much more, and yet your brief seemed to say it's more likely to be justified under the Constitution. I'd like to know with some specificity how that could be.
Well, because you have to measure the under the standard of equal protection scrutiny that we think this Court's cases require.
I know the principle, but I'm saying which are there good arguments, in your opinion, that would be good enough to overcome the state that does nothing but not good enough to overcome California, where they do a lot?
Well, what we're saying about that is that we're not prepared to close the door to an argument in another state where the state's interests haven't cut the legs out from under the arguments. And I suppose the caution rationale that Mr. Cooper identified with respect to the effects on children, if it came up in a different case with a different record, after all, here, this case was litigated by petitioners on the theory that rational basis applied and they didn't need to show anything. And so they didn't try to show anything.
Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia expressed similar concerns about the government's position.
But is it the position of the United States that same-sex marriage is not required throughout the country?
We're not we are not taking the position that it is required throughout the country. We think that that ought to be left open for future adjudication in other states that don't have the situation California has.
So your position is only if a state allows civil unions does it become unconstitutional to forbid same-sex marriage, right?
I see my
light. Oh, you can go on.
Good. Thank you. It's our position is I would just take out a red pen and take the word only out of that sentence. When that is true, then the Equal Protection Clause forbids the exclusion of same-sex marriage, and it's an open question otherwise. And if I could just get to the third reason, which I do think is quite significant, the argument here is about caution. It's an argument that, well, we need to wait. We understand that. We take it seriously. But waiting is not a neutral act. Waiting imposes real costs in the here and now. It denies to the parents who want to marry the ability to marry, and it denies to the children, ironically, the very thing that petitioners focus on is at the heart of the marriage relationship.
So, but you're willing to wait in the rest of the country. You say it's got to happen right now in California, but you don't even have a position about whether it's required in the rest of the country.
With respect to a state that allows gay couples to have children and to have families and then denies the stabilized...
So it's got to happen right away in those states where same-sex couples have every legal right that married couples do.
Well, we think
but you can wait in states where they have fewer legal rights.
What I've said is an open question with respect to those states, and a court should wait and see what kind of a record a state could make. But in California, you can't make the record to justify the exclusion.